Hey, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Blind Ambition with Jack Kelly. It's your friend Rick from Blind, and today I'm going to introduce you to Max Tagger, who's the co-founder and chief technology officer at Mercury. Mercury is a financial technology company offering startup founders free checking and savings accounts, debit and credit cards, wire transfers, treasury, venture debt, and more. You might have heard of them if you've been following kind of the recent bank collapses, because they picked up quite a few customers then. Max and his co-founders launched Mercury in 2019, and today they have more than 100,000 startups as customers. Mercury's last public valuation was $1.6 billion in 2021. Thanks for coming on the show, Max.
Thank you. Thanks, Rick.
So Max, can you walk us through your career? Because we're pretty impressed with your background. You went from a software engineer and now co-founder and CTO of one of the most talked about startups. How did you go from A to B?
Yeah, so when I was 20 years old, I dropped out of school and I joined the startup called HeyZap. And that was co-founded by Ahmad, who's one of my co-founders at Mercury. And then like 3 months after I joined, the other co-founder of Mercury, Jason, he joined HeyZap as well. And at HeyZap, I started off like as an iOS engineer. And then I expanded into some like backend engineering with Ruby and Java. And then that's pretty much it. You know, I wasn't like a manager, like a high level person at HeyZap or anything. I was always a pretty small company. And that was acquired after maybe like 4 years. We worked at the acquiring company for a year and a half, and that was totally miserable experience. Then we started Mercury together. I can get into kind of like, you know, like why we kind of did Mercury as part of that story.
What would make you do that, Max? Like, did you have a banking background beforehand, or were you interested in banking?
No. In fact, neither, myself, Jason, and Ahmad, we didn't have any banking backgrounds, no like prior experience in that. You know, basically what led us into that is at HeyZap, we had used Silicon Valley Bank, which is, for context, like, you know, at the time, at least, they probably had over 50% of all startups banking with them, I'd guess. And so maybe First Republic and number two. So we had been using Silicon Valley Bank and were pretty dissatisfied with it. Like a specific need we had was we were an ad network at HeyZap, or that was like one of the pivots. And we needed to pay out a lot of these ad publishers, and we needed to do it through a variety of payment methods. And that was always like this big manual process at the end of the month. And we ideally would have had like an API from our bank to kind of automate this process. We didn't have anything like that. So that was like a specific need. But beyond that, Ahmad had talked to a lot of other startups and knew they were pretty dissatisfied with their like startup bank, like usually SVB, through some mix of like fees or like the technology wasn't very good or like other reasons for being dissatisfied. That's kind of what drove us to kind of like get into banking. And maybe like to go like a little bit deeper there on like why startups. There's like a lot of actually different reasons there. So part of doing startups is that, we understood startups really well. Ahmad had all these connections, knew people were dissatisfied. Startups also naturally, they're great customers because they are by definition starting a new business. So it's way easier to acquire them as a customer because they don't have a bank account yet versus like trying to get someone to switch. Banking is very sticky, but I think this is like probably good advice for like most industries. Startup founders, they're like less risk averse, like they're more into like using startups for their products, versus like use IBM or whatever. And startups, they want like new technology, like they want to use the Gustos of the world versus like paychecks or whatever the corporate thing is. I think part of that is, they both like naturally appreciate like a good UX and stuff like that. But also, if they are like losing their time and energy and focus dealing with like paychecks or whatever, like awful corporate enterprise thing, that's like a real like cost to them because they have so many things on, you know, begging for their attention as a startup founder. Whereas with Mercury, you know, we can get rid of all that stress and like make it so much easier for people. So I think that's part of it as well. And maybe I close out with like startups just have like a ton of money in their bank accounts. So, you know, that makes them great for, you know, like as a customer for a bank, that it's three people, but have $5 million in their bank account. So serving a smaller company, but you're still making good revenue off it without charging people like a bunch of monthly fees or whatever.
So interesting, Max, because it sounds like your experience, even though you didn't come from banking, your experience is like, I really didn't like dealing with Silicon Valley Bank. And actually, you got the last laugh because we know what happened to Silicon Valley. It imploded. So it maybe is a good reason for it. But and so by doing that, because you weren't happy with it, you're like, you know what? We could do a better job. Let's do it. Right? I love that attitude. That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's like absolutely like how we got there. I do think it's tricky, you know, like starting a bank like has a huge moat around it. And I don't think it would have been possible if not for Ahmad, you know, having already had a somewhat successful startup with HeyZap in the first place, because he was able to, you know, talk to investors and like, you know, by the time I had like flown back from, we had like a lake house vacation in Tennessee, by the time I had flown back to San Francisco to, you know, join Ahmad and Jason, we had like already raised our seed round within a few weeks. And, you know, it took us a year and a half to build the like, you know, wide, you know, like table stakes suite of features to build a bank. So I absolutely do think it is like the attitude of like, hey, like this is bad. We need to go out there and fix it. But it's not to say it's easy. There was quite a lot getting to that point. So, yeah.
Now, Max, is it the bank? Do you run the bank or is it that you're the intermediary with other financial institutions that offer a different array of investments and banking and other kind of products?
Yeah, that's a very good clarification. So we are not like a federally licensed bank or anything. The way we work is we have like various partner banks who actually, you know, hold the federal banking license. They store your funds, you know, they have the regulatory oversight. And then we provide, from your perspective, like everything you deal with, you know, we are the website and the customer support, and you never, you know, hopefully have to think about our banking partners. And when Mercury launched, that was like, you know, even more true because, you know, we would use someone who's like very much like a middleman, a technology provider. They have like, you know, normal HTTP APIs and you interact with them and they keep track of a lot of stuff on their side. It can be very painful to deal with intermediaries for a variety of reasons, you know, like you're more disconnected from the bank. They might have technical issues. They don't represent things as like the way you need them to. So over time, we have basically like eaten away at all these middleman layers. And, you know, now we do our own anti-money laundering and we parse the raw files, the NACHA files for ACH and send those off to the Federal Reserve. You know, through our banking intermediaries, but basically taking it all on ourselves. So that's definitely been a theme for Mercury, is moving in that direction. Maybe we eventually become a real bank. That's like a tricky, you know, regulatory thing, a long process, depends on like who's in the White House. But yeah, that's kind of how we got there.
I'm so impressed because, you know, when your name first came across our desk, right? You were a software engineer. You had never become like a manager or like a director or any like fancy titles. And now you're a startup founder, a CTO. Can you walk us through that transition? Like how you were able to navigate, you know, stepping into that executive role for the first time? You know, was it easy to kind of convince other engineers, your peers maybe, to come and join the startup in the early days? Can you kind of walk us through those early days?
Yeah. I had never been a manager at HeyZap. We honestly, it's like I didn't really have a manager at HeyZap too much either. It didn't seem like a big issue as far as convincing people to join Mercury. I think early on, a lot of the like experience you get from being like a higher level, like manager or director, you know, there's a lot of like really important business functions that mid-level companies need or big companies like, like leveling matrices and like career growth talks and all that. And that is important for those size companies. Like every company that has that as an existence proof is like important at their size. But at a small size, I don't think it is as essential as, you know, like a decent technical vision, like really good understanding of customer problems, some of the like the values that you have, because you really have like a more like human connection with the early people you're working with. Like it's more like, you know, do I really like working with this person more so than is this person like an incredible manager that can set me up for success or whatever? And I will say we did have the advantage of like having done a successful startup before with HeyZap. And I think that probably carries more weight than I was a big shot at Amazon or something like that, which is probably pretty far from the startup experience.
No, I really appreciate that insight because I think, especially in the blind community, there's a lot of pressure among engineers where, you know, a lot of them work at more established startups. They work at these huge public companies. And, you know, some of them have side projects or they're really interested in kind of pursuing a passion project that might eventually one day become a startup. And they look at their background, they look at their CV, and they think like, well, no one's going to give me money because I'm just a regular, you know, individual contributor, or, you know, I've never done a startup before. It might be challenging to recruit folks or get that fundraising or even know what to do in terms of how to talk to or find a venture capitalist or an investor to get my idea off the ground. But with your background, I find it so incredible because you just strip it down to kind of the first principles, right? And having a clear like technical vision of what is my problem? What am I actually going to solve or what I'm going to seek to solve? And what's my like unique insight, right? And it seems like you and your co-founders had the firsthand experience of, well, I know exactly what I'm going to target. Like I've experienced this problem myself. I know others probably have felt it too. And so I can very easily get my first few customers.
Yeah. If I was to like give advice to that kind of group you're talking about that is, you know, at the Amazons, like, I think you're probably better off working for a startup to start a startup than to like go from a really big company. I admittedly, you know, like I haven't like sold to a lot of venture capitalists directly, but just as far as experience goes, like that seems to be a more important thing. I think I'd probably also say that there's many types of startups. So like what I'll say here is not like gonna be true for every single type of company. Like the CTO for like a crypto company is very different than like a self-driving car AI company versus Mercury. For Mercury, and honestly, I think a lot of startups, having like more of the like product experience will be really important as an engineer versus like being the best possible programmer. You know, at HeyZap, I talked to like our developers directly. You know, we built like an SDK for mobile developers. So I talked to them on Skype to help like debug their issues. I take what issues they had and turn that into documentation to prevent it from happening again. I went to like sales dinners with our like top game developers and, you know, was able to be like a peer to the salespeople. Like, I think that's like probably like more the direction I'd push than being like an incredible manager or, you know, like the best possible on technical side. And then on the technical side, I'd probably push for like a certain amount of like breadth there more, you know, like more so than being the best possible backend engineer. You know, you'll need to have experience in, you know, some front end, some back end, being really good at translating a customer problem like end to end to getting to a solution. And then what you do kind of need on the like front end and back end is like enough experience there to like have good taste in the technologies you choose, that you kind of set like a good foundation that things like aren't a mess there, but you don't need to be the super deep end compiler expert for most startups.
I mean, what have you found the most kind of surprising or challenging as, you know, the years have gone by, you know, like Admittedly, like Mercury launched in 2019, so we're just talking about 3-4 years now. But you know, how has your role as a startup founder, as a CTO, as one of the first technical folks at a startup, how has it changed over that time?
Yeah. Okay. So, on your question of like how my role has changed, man, like it's changed a lot. You know, you come in to the company and you're like, you're a programmer at first, but through the whole time at the company, you're doing a little bit of everything. You know, you are like figuring out compensation for people and figuring out hiring, and like you're doing like a little bit of management, and then you're like being interviewed on podcasts and stuff like that. So there's a very wide range in what you're doing, and it's changing all the time, which makes it very tricky. Like you're never quite comfortable, and you're not necessarily having someone tell you like that you're doing the right thing or like what to do next. Like you kind of have to believe in yourself and like kind of figure that out. So that's part of it. Maybe like touching on your question of like the most challenging bit. Honestly, like the most challenging bit for Mercury is just like dealing with partners. And like I've talked before about like all the instability that comes, you know, with having those. And it's always like really dangerous to have your business in a position where like another company changing their policies could, you know, throw your whole company under the bus. So we've had to do like a lot of work over time to ameliorate that. And then that's like a challenge on like the business, the product, the even the technical side, that you're like trying to load balance between these different partners, but they were never designed to like be used like that because bank accounts aren't super fungible to just shift from like one institution to another. So that becomes like another big challenge that we deal with as well.
So do you start, are there times that you start weighing and say, hey, maybe instead of having the different partners, build it more ourselves internally and have, you know, in-house as opposed to out, you know, outside entities? Or do you have ambitions to really grow it huge? And then all of a sudden that's going to change for you too, in terms of how you manage and oversee it?
Okay, so definitely over time, we're moving the direction of like handling more and more stuff ourselves. Like I mentioned, like parsing the raw Notcha files for ACH transactions, talking directly to the Federal Reserve. How far you go in that, I think, is a tricky question. So like on the banking partners specifically, that is interesting because, you know, part of the risk with Silicon Valley Bank is they were like very concentrated in startup customers. And, you know, they were this public bank that was like really optimizing for short-term decisions as far as like, you know, short-term revenue that put them in big risk if interest rates rose. And one of our strengths is that, you know, by having multiple partners, it does mean that you can be, you know, more resilient to, you know, like a particular issue that one of them had. Here's maybe kind of an example. Do you remember the FTX? And like, how can you not remember the FTX thing?
Yeah.
So there was this like rumor spread by some VCs that one of our partner banks was like deeply enmeshed with it and insolvent. And they like, you know, emailed a bunch of our portfolio companies and said, you got to get your money out of Mercury because like their partner bank's insolvent. And, you know, we had to do like a big PR crisis thing to say, like, talk to a bunch of people and convince them like, hey, you know, this is like this totally unfounded rumor. There's nothing to it. You know, but it helped to be able to say, like, if you do have any concern with it, we're happy to move your money to our other partner bank. And that made people feel a lot better that it kind of, you know, totally resolved that issue. That they didn't have to take any chance that this rumor was true. And that actually set us up really well that had happened, because, you know, people were like, the investors would email people and say, like, got to get your money out of Mercury, get into SVB, they're safe. And then like 3 months later, you know, it was like November this happened. And then like February, SVB thing happened. SVB was like undergoing like a collapse and had to be rescued by the government and stuff like that. So, yeah.
So, but in a way you kind of benefited from that, right? Like you learned from those mistakes and said, hey, we could build a better product, better system, more safety.
Yeah, absolutely. Silicon Valley Bank has been like a good demonstration of like how important it is to people to, you know, show them some of the like underlying details of like how banking works, you know, explain some of these, like, you know, like what I was talking about before is like pretty tricky about like, you know, how safe is your money in a bank versus like in mutual funds backed by treasury bonds? And like, why would need one more insurance? Like, there's a lot of complexity around that stuff. And we've had to do, you know, a lot of customer education because we're unfortunately like no longer in the pre-SVB world of like, hey, people have total trust in, you know, all banks. And we think that like what we're offering is like pretty rock solid, but like it takes a lot of, you know, effort to go through that. And we've, you know, after Silicon Valley Bank had their issues, we immediately started to work on public landing pages to explain how the whole stack works. That way we can, you know, share that out, build relationships in the ecosystem with the right people to make sure that, you know, the various VCs and, you know, CFOs and lawyers are convinced and everything. So yeah, you're absolutely right that unfortunately some of their issues have been a good lesson for us.
You know, I really appreciate this kind of like education behind the scenes look, right? Because you didn't have a financial technology background or even a banking background, but you're so able to like clearly describe and explain these kind of complex systems and rules to me and Jack. And, you know, I'm curious, do you have any advice for the engineers, the technologists, the folks that are listening right now? Like, some folks might feel nervous or shy away from entering a specific industry because they feel like they haven't had that firsthand experience in that industry, right? Like, I can't work in financial technology because I've never worked in banking, or I've never worked in fintech, or, you know, everyone right now is so interested in machine learning and artificial intelligence, but they wouldn't describe themselves as a machine learning engineer or anything of that sort. How can those folks, just like you, get into this, you know, hot field, or this field that they're personally interested in, or this field that they, you know, feel like they have a unique perspective that they can solve and kind of quote unquote like break through? Is it just kind of getting over the mentals in their head and saying like, hey, actually, it's not required, and pushing ahead? Or how did you learn those skills and get that confidence?
Okay, so there's definitely a portion of it that is just like, hey, you're going to have to take a leap of faith and believe in yourself that you'll be able to figure these things out. And that when you, you know, have blind spots, that you can hire people either on a full-time basis or like contract with people who are, you know, advisors for people on how to like set up neobanks and stuff like that. So that is definitely part of it, is believing in that. I do think there's a degree that you have to like learn as well. And I do think it helps to have some part of it that's like building for yourself. Like, it's true that, you know, going into this, neither like Ahmad nor Jason or I were like had this like deep banking expertise. But we did have a lot of like expertise in startups. So we could like build the product for ourselves. And It wasn't like we were, you know, like doing something where we had like no idea what good looked like. So I think like that would be part of it. And then I do think, you know, I'll say like a lot of like Ahmad did this, you know, when he was coming up with the idea of Mercury that helped, is you need to understand some of the like macro stuff a little bit. To figure out like if you're in a good time for the business. So like after the 2008 collapse, the government had like had huge crackdowns, like was not issuing any new banking charters. And a lot of the way that banking like regulation works is it's less like written down policies. And sometimes it's more like, how are your like personal relationships and vibes with regulators? And the vibes at that time were not good for like doing like neobanking or something like that. I think that like, Simple might have got kind of hit with this, like Bank Simple, like it was like a bad time for them. So we didn't at least need to like know enough to like have the right timing on like when this is going to be good regulatory wise, you know, when it's like, you know, we're going to get support for this from like third parties, like the technology had to be there. And like the technology was not fully there for us. Like the technology is way better now that like Stripe Treasury and stuff is out. But you did have to understand some of it, but like not necessarily like all the low level details. You can outsource some of that out. Yeah.
Do you think, guys, curious, Rick and Max, is there maybe a benefit to go into something with like a beginner's mindset? where, you know, as opposed to someone, I've been in Citigroup for 20 years, and this is how we do it at Citigroup. And I've been at JP Morgan for 25 years. Here's how it goes, to come into it with a fresh perspective. So then you could look at it differently. For instance, instead of you taking everything and putting it in-house, you're like, wait, why do I have to do that? I'll have partners that are the best at what they do, and I'll get the best partners so we don't have to build it from scratch. Is that maybe a competitive advantage to have that way of thinking? So you could kind of reframe it and said, hey, I don't have to do it the way Citigroup does it or JP Morgan does it. We'll do it our own way. And we'll stand, and then this way we'll stand out in the market because we're different.
I would say it's like a tricky balance. yeah. There's like absolutely value to like knowing how it's done at other places. And you know, like A, like knowing if that works or doesn't. And certain things are like things you want to copy over more than others. You know, take our like send money flow where you need to like send a wire out. You know, for that, we could really think from first principles and start from a blank slate of like, what is the ideal way to do that? And, you know, just work from like, okay, these are like the fields that the wire form needs. Like, let's backport into that. What's being, or what, how to ask that to the customer. Same with like the questions you need to ask to onboard a customer, like all the upfront questions for like regulatory purposes. So you can do like a lot of that without looking at what the UIs of the other banks look like. But, you know, those banks do understand things and like do things well. And it's like value to copy experience from them. Like an example we've had of that is, you know, how do other banks make decisions about like how long you should hold the funds from a check before dispersing them to customers? And, you know, how do you make decisions on like what limits should be for like how much like a customer can wire out in a given day? Like there's still valuable things to learn. And, you know, that's like especially true, I'd say, like the compliance and risk side. But you're not wrong either. Like it is important to come at things from a fresh perspective to be willing to like think of things from first principles. There needs to be a pretty healthy tension there, but like you definitely can't be in the situation where you're not pushing back on things just because, like you can't just be accepting the way that things were done before are the right way. You have to like, and this applies to a lot of things in business, not just, you know, like how other banks do it. You do have to like push back and like make sure that everything makes sense and you could justify it to any given person that this is the way it's done and this is why it's going to be the best way.
Is it also this, Rick and Max, that with we've spoken through the podcast to so many CTOs and very experienced tech folks and they're very accomplished. Could it be that they feel, hey, if I'm a really good software engineer, I could do it. We could do it. And then we could just find the right people to do everything else. It's like a whole different mindset in terms of building these kind of businesses. We're like, all right, hey, we know how we can kind of build the infrastructure from the technology point of view. And that's the, you know, hardest part. And then once we do that, I think you even alluded to this early in the conversation, then we could find the right people for the right jobs.
I don't want to over-index on like technology, the most important part, because, you know, for us, like design is like absolutely huge at Mercury.
Oh, okay.
You know, like, you know, I'd say the thing that like makes Mercury successful most is people are like, yeah, I really love using this product. Things are so intuitive. You know, it's so easy to send a wire. And like, I do an onboarding demo for everyone at the company every couple of weeks for new people. And I show them like, okay, here's First Republic's page. How do you send a wire on this page? And it takes people like maybe like a minute and a half to figure out like what to click even to know what to do.
Yeah.
It's very convoluted from there.
Wires are right. Yeah. Wires are a pain in the butt to do, right? There's certain things that are so annoying and it can be improved upon. So you've worked on like figuring those pain points out and trying to change it, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. And design's like absolutely critical to that. You know, we added in like product functions later. You know, there's definitely stuff to earn from other disciplines. And I would say people should not go into it from the perspective of like the technology is the most important part. And I just need to get right out. I'll like outsource everything else. If anything, like you yourself need to be like pretty good at design thinking and product thinking. And the technology's a little bit second, at least for a certain brand of startup where it's not, you know, like, I don't know, building the next new database or something.
Yeah. I really appreciate that advice, because I think oftentimes there's in tech, we like make the assumption of what our user actually wants, right? So we like hear one anecdote, or we've had this like personal experience, and we think like, oh, well, like most everyone probably has to think the same way. And you start building this product or building this stack that is just based on assumptions. You launch it, and then your users are like, what the hell is this? Or like, I actually can't do what I need to do. So I really appreciate like your reminder to engineers, to technical co-founders, to almost take that like product hat early on and like not even like outsource it to a product manager or a product marketing manager, but like really do that discovery work yourself, right? And say, yeah, I'm actually going to put myself in the shoes. What does it actually look like? Is what I'm building actually something that people want? I think too often we get into like this intellectual kind of game, and we start to like not think of all that like practical reality.
So I'm curious.
So you mentioned this, like when you onboard new employees to Mercury, you kind of give them this preview, you walk through this exercise of how things at Mercury compare versus, you know, the other banks or the other folks that are out there. Can we take a step back and say, like, what's the job interview process look like at Mercury?
I'll need to first start with like some of my like high level principles on like, you know, what would go into making the process. Because remember, I said like I had never done this before. So first thing I did is like go read the Hacker News comments on like what people say is like really awful or really good about job interviews at other companies. One of the people I really liked is like TP Tasek. He's like the number one commenter on Hacker News, and he was saying, you know, like top things that seem to work in the like research literature on job interviews are like one, IQ tests, which are like super controversial and like legally fraught, and two, doing like work sample tests, which is like try to give something that is as close to what the actual job is, instead of, for example, you know, like asking like about algorithms or something like that, that isn't maybe reflective of what the real world's like. And then like, I also, I try and avoid questions that are more like, tell me about a time you did X or whatever, because those tend to be like really long backstories, and the person can kind of bullshit their way through it, or at the very least, it's like very much through their lens of thinking. All right, so like those high level principles in mind, job interview process. The first interview I do has someone take a spec for a product, like, you know, and you know, say it's like you're building this like mini Airbnb or whatever it is. And then I say that an intern at the company has been tasked with building this, and they had this proposed database schema. I want you to take a few minutes to read through the schema and the spec. And when you're ready, you can kind of walk me through a like a verbal code review of, you know, what you know, what you'd say to them. And this thing has like a number of benefits to it. You know, one is that it really like meshes in the product thinking that we've been talking about, like, you know, making sure that the things from the spec are reflected in the code, and then maybe even going like a step further, you know, like the spec asks for this, but they might not actually want that. What instead they might want is something else, or like they didn't ask for this, but you know, they will want this eventually, so we can plan for it now. Like, you get some of that. You get like pretty high level thinking about, you know, like how to build a product. And it mixes in things that are both like good for like a new engineer, because you don't have to like jump in and like write stuff from scratch on the phone. You're able to like read something and just kind of like work off your general thinking. And even an experienced engineer, like code review is like a very important part of the job, so they're experienced with it too. So that's like the last 30 minutes of my first call. Then actually the first 15 minutes, this is really important. I just spend that time having people ask me questions. And reasons I consider this important. I think it like it sets the tone with people that this interview isn't just like, you know, you grilling them. It's also them. And you know, like it shouldn't feel like they're being grilled as a side thing, but you know, they should be trying to understand if they're like a good fit for the company and you're the right thing for them. And asking those questions up front helps a lot, because it just really reduces the pressure of the interview and, you know, lets that person, you know, get into what matters to them, feel comfortable before you start talking about the tech side. So that's like first interview segment. There's two more. Second is we do like a coding exercise where we give you like a prompt, and it's drawn from like a real world issue we had. And we say, okay, spend 2 hours on this, and you know, we'll come back after then, and then you can go walk us through what you did. And during that time, you know, they can use the internet, they can use whatever programming language they want, they can read Stack Overflow. You know, basically, again, we're making it like as realistic as possible. And then when the interviewers comes back, they can ask them about the code, but they can also get into like questions that would show someone has more experience. Like, okay, how do you get this into production? How do you convince, you know, the finance team who you're replacing their manual process that your new process is preferable? And, you know, maybe a bad answer is like, I would just like write a lot of tests for that. It was a very technical answer versus like, I would run my process in parallel with the finance teams, and it'd show when it's different, and it would show how, like, why the algorithm makes the decision it does and help them believe in it. Final part of our interview process is we do like a kind of like a product exercise, which is not exactly, but close to, you know, maybe tell me about an app that you use a lot, and, you know, what do you think are the top issues users have with that app? And then, you know, like, how would you go about like solving those issues? So again, like a very product focused question. And this product stuff, I'd say, is like very important if you are hiring your like initial few engineers at a company. And then as we've gotten a lot bigger, we have maybe 150 engineers now, we have a lot more latitude to like hire a compiler engineer or some other specialist.
Are there any common mistakes? You kind of touched on this, that you see engineers make in the interview process, like kind of getting too technical and in the weeds too quickly, or, you know, not thinking about like the trade-offs required and in terms of, you know, outlining a certain decision or a certain outcome?
I do think those are things that happens, like, you know, people not considering the product side. And I don't know how much that's like a mistake versus just like not having the experience.
Mm.
I would somewhat say like, if you are seeing people have a lot of common mistakes, that like might be a symptom that there's like something wrong with the interview process. Like, you know, like if like the mistake is, you know, people don't really remember like dynamic algorithms or something like that as like a possible solution to things, then like that might be more of a sign that the reason it's a common mistake is because it's like not like actually used in people's day to day. So people just naturally don't know it, or maybe you're not like setting them up for success in terms of process. Like, the mistake is they don't have like their IDE set up and they're like uncomfortable in this new like weird text pad you're using, you know.
Right.
Tell them to come in with that set up and you solve that. Maybe like a final one on like common mistakes, actually. Something that's tricky is that when people are asking questions just about the company, they sometimes will ask a question and like the subtext of that question is like what they really care about. So like they will ask maybe directly, what is the distribution of like junior to senior people of the company? And, you know, the interviewer might answer that directly and say like, this is the distribution. But like the reason they maybe ask about that is because they are worried that they won't get enough mentorship at the company, or they think that like the technical debt situation of the company is like going to be a total mess. And maybe that when the manager answers their direct question, they just kind of move on from that. So what I encourage people to do is like, you know, be direct, ask, you know, dig in and like ask the things you really care about. That definitely comes up. Yeah. Oh yeah. It's like the conversational aspect, A, like it feels really comfortable to the people doing it. And yeah, it gives you that like broad spectrum, you know, what it's going to be like with them. You know, this is what it's really like on the job. So yeah, I think that's really important to have that feeling. Then the like rehearsed, you know, like questions right. That are like, oh, these are the normal interview questions kind of thing.
Right. Cause then you get the person, you get a real good check of like what they're like. And if you have that conversation for a while, then you could kind of get some feelings too. Like, this person's a little weird, or this person is a little obnoxious, or this person is very pompous. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to write them off, but you're just making a mental note. All right, I got to, in future interviews with other people,
yes,
I'm going to ask them to keep an eye out and see how are they feeling the same way.
Yes, that's like advice I get people on the first interview is like, you know, you don't have, it's like, it's not wrong to, you know, send the person on and, you know, like not reject too many people. It would be a mistake if you don't note the concerns like you talked about, like this person was like kind of hard to work with. Like you need to note that for next people and like look for those common themes. And you know, the really important gate is like, do you hire the person or not? Not do you spend another couple hours interviewing them, which is way lower cost. And also like, you know, your first interview, people are like nervous. They, you know, it might be a one-off thing. So that's why it's also important not to like judge too much on the first call.
No, I find it fascinating because, you know, my world, PR communications, I'm often interviewing with CEOs, CFOs, board members. And oftentimes it's very much based on, do I trust Rick's judgment, right? That's what it comes down to, where, you know, the recruiter or the other folks, they've screened me in terms of like the relationships, the hard skills. And so I'm often surprised when sometimes like my interviews are just over coffees, right? Or lunch. And it's this kind of back and forth banter to kind of figure out like, oh, how does Rick actually think, right? And so I really love these insights into kind of the different worlds of interviews, right? Mine is like less technical and more kind of, to Jack's point, a bit on the vibe. Oh man. So, well, speaking of the vibe, can you describe kind of the engineering culture that you tried to build at Mercury and kind of how your interview process kind of screens into that and plugs into that?
Yeah. So, okay. So like, you know, culture is like many things at companies, so you can like dig in on whatever you want, but one part of it is, you know, Mercury has a pretty high like emphasis on quality. And, you know, this is coming from multiple directions. You know, it's coming from the design side because, you know, we're not building something that is like, you know, so fundamentally new, like, I don't know, like a cryptocurrency or something that we can just win on that. Like, it has to be really high quality because you can get the same underlying domestic wires at Chase. So that's part of it, quality. That also comes in on like the tactical side. Like, you know, we use this more niche programming language. It's called Haskell, and it has really good features for static typing to help prevent errors. And that is part of like the quality side as well. Like, how do we, you know, make sure everything's going to be correct? Because people really care about correctness in banking, because of course they should. So, you know, quality is a big part of it. You know, focusing on like the customer and the product is a big part of it as well. You know, for a long time at Mercury, we did not have product managers, engineers and designers were very much like driving the sort of product roadmap part. And even now that we just had a product org starting from maybe like a year or so ago, they're still very much a part of that process of like, you know, talking to customers, figuring out what the roadmap should be, and like the individual line level teams, you know, like the card spin team or the dashboard team, are figuring out what their roadmap should be. And ideally they're pushing that up versus, you know, the executives kind of pushing it down, which sometimes needs to happen, but like, you know, I would say shouldn't be the default, at least at Mercury. So yeah, those would be like, I think, two pretty big aspects of our culture. Maybe like the final thing is, I think Mercury is just like a fun place to work in terms of like, hey, like there's all these like fun Slack channels of like people doing crosswords together or playing games, and you know, people build friendships here and stuff like that as well. I think that's a nice part to have as part of your culture, that you know, people actually enjoy working there.
That it's not like working like a bank where you're dressed up and you go 9 to 5 and you kind of just
have this
clock in and clock out.
Yeah, because you know, the work's not like always going to be fun, you know, especially in like certain roles. You know, like an advantage we have is that, you know, I'd mentioned this niche programming language, Haskell. We have people who come to work at Mercury because it has been their dream since forever to like use Haskell. And we have two people at Mercury who have like written books about Haskell, and other people want to come work with them. You know, like that's like really, you know, that's a great selling point for a customer or for like a, you know, engineers. There's going to be days where you as a support agent are, you know, on phone rotation and like a customer is angry with you because they're unreasonable. And, you know, during those times, I think it's going to help to have like a fun company culture where you can go back to people. And like, we were solving like a crossword puzzle the other day and, you know, relax and enjoy that. Because the work is sometimes going to be challenging. So, yeah.
No, I appreciate that sneak peek into the interview process, what you look for and what it's actually like to work at Mercury. Thanks for coming on the show and sharing your experience.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been really fun to talk.
That's it for The Blind Ambition. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review.
And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.